I suppose it's my job to sort of launch things off, and then we'll have, you'll answer the questions, not me, but I'll select the people. So that you can't give preference to your friends who showed up. So my question, I mean, you made a case at the end for, I think it's an important one, kind of piety about the founding, which is, and you argue, is a rational piety, because there are things that we rightly venerate about our nation's founding principles, is important to sustain us in a way in our commitment to try to promote the common good in a moment that it seems like that's quite difficult. But if I'm a neo-Catholic, my challenge to you would be to say, okay, all right, you made your case. Maybe we're simplifying and distorting the true nature of the political philosophy of the founders. But why did things go so wrong? Mm-hmm. So it seems a burden. They at least are giving us an explanation for why things are going wrong, that modern liberal political theory is of its nature, if not the cause of our problems, at the very least, it leaves us disarmed in facing those problems. And so what would you say is, I mean, obviously you said that's another lecture, but give us a sense of where you think, why you think we are in this very bad situation.
That's what I tried to anticipate at the end of the lecture, right? That was my crack about the baby boomer generation. It's not altogether untrue, right? So it's very easy to blame. I mean, so the critics who blame the founding get a lot of attention. That's interesting, right? Americans are predisposed to like the founding. And when you have conservatives criticizing the founding, that's a way to get lots of attention. And it sort of explains everything, right? The principles were bad. It's the working out of the principles, and that explains everything. It's too easy. One, it's wrong. Two, it's too easy. So you have to really go through American history. And the thing about the experiment, so the founders always talked about our experiment in free government. It's an experiment because it may or may not work, right? If you aim at a politics of freedom, everything depends on how well the people use their freedom. And that's why education was so important to the founders, right? I mean, Jefferson was so proud of the University of Virginia. What was the university supposed to teach? It was supposed to teach the political principles of freedom. So if people could use its freedom well. The best example of that is Abraham Lincoln, right? If you've read the Lincoln-Douglas debates, I mean, Lincoln talks about our ancient faith, the Declaration of Independence. That's how we explain why slavery is wrong, right? I mean, that you could have a military leader and a statesman and a political genius who understood our principles. It's providential. But think about the idea, what happened to the idea of natural rights after Lincoln? It completely disappears. Do you know what Woodrow Wilson, it's fashionable now to criticize Woodrow Wilson, so I'm going to jump on this case. Do you know what Woodrow Wilson said about the Declaration of Independence? And we hold these truths. He said, it would have been better if that paragraph had been eliminated. It means nothing. He liked the grievances against the king, but he didn't like this appeal to nature. And there was a sustained attack on the principles of natural rights and nature as a standard, right? John Dewey says, you know, great, hugely influential in American education, says we need to get rid of the idea of natural rights. And that entered into our, and why did that enter into our political lexicon? Well, Marx and Darwin and the idea of progress. Right? If we're going to progress, and if history is progressive, why be limited to these timeless principles? Right? And so there are huge changes in our self-understanding as a nation, and we see those play out over the, and those are necessary to get the huge growth in government we get first with FDR and then the Great Society. And so that's where I would turn. I would say, to the extent we have abandoned our solid political principles, and with it we've introduced all sorts of pathologies in our life. But it's not just that. It's not just that there are different bad, you know, the critics say these principles are bad, I say these other principles are bad. I mean, the family has not broken down because of political principles. the family has broken down because people have made bad choices, right? And just we as a generation have not, or you as a generation had not lived well, and then you raised us. And, you know, so what do we do? Well, right, I'm not going to make anyone good by this lecture, right? It's husbands and wives having good marriages and raising solid children and with good moral education, one family at a time. There's no substitute for that, right? It's actually how we live in our individual lives and communities. That's the only thing that's really going to save us.
Right. Miriam, why not?
Why not? Thank you. That was fascinating. I would like to propose just a friendly amendment kind of thought here by potentially widening the circle of blame. Because if, in answer to your question, what happened, if it's fair to ask whether the Constitution somehow was bad for America, whether neo-Catholic thinkers are not helping, I think it is past time to ask this question, which is, is secularist progressivism good for America? You, in paraphrasing Hamilton, you had a striking phrase that we have no moral right to harm others. And by now, I would argue secularist progressivism itself has amassed quite a record of doing exactly that. There is the empirical record, of course, built out of sociology and simple fact-finding about what the sexual revolution has done to women, to children, to families, etc. We can even leave that aside. There's a much more obvious example right in front of us that Father Thomas Joseph alluded to, and that is the Little Sisters of the Poor. I would like to introduce what I hope is a new thought here. The issue isn't only that the government is beating up on the Little Sisters of the Poor, and as you point out, if you're willing to do that, what aren't you willing to do? The issue is that in any other universe, the idea that you would take on charities, that you would wake up in the morning and your mission in life, what gets you out of bed, is trying to take resources away from people who help people, this would be seen as delusional. And I think it's past time that we can point out that delusion, and not only in the case of the Little Sisters, but also, for example, the National Abortion Rights Action League sues pregnancy centers around the country. These are places where women can go and get diapers and advice and access to medical resources. Who would do that, okay? I mean, it's one thing to say you're pro-choice, but obviously there's a lot more going on under that surface rhetoric, because this isn't being pro-choice at all. Putting resources out of the way of women who need them is a cruel thing to do. So when we're talking about whom to blame for where we are, and I think the case can be made that there's a lot of blame to go around, but the number one elephant in the middle of it all is secularist progressivism itself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that. You have to ask, well, what motivates that ideology? And it's a certain understanding of freedom, which I think is impoverished. And why do they think Little Sisters of the Poor to take? Why would you be threatened by Little Sisters of the Poor? But they are threatened by Little Sisters of the Poor. And the answer, I think, is because they see this as, if Little Sisters of the Poor are correct in their understanding of the human person and the human good, then the ideology they have is wrong. And that's unsustainable. So they're a deep threat. So I concur with your sentiments.
All right. Bill Carroll. As you were talking about the quotations that you were giving from the founders, I was thinking, when you talked about creator, nature, reason, don't we have to ask, well, what do they mean by these words? In other words, when they talk about creator, they really have a kind of designer notion, a deistic notion of creator. They have a kind of stoic philosophy, so forth, all of which, that such a notion of creator can and has been easily done away with by developments in science to which Jefferson points. So wouldn't we rather say that the founding principles, perhaps not corrupt, but inadequate, and inadequate when it comes precisely to talking about creator, nature,
and reason, and that inadequacy leads to a lot of these problems.
Yeah, but I don't buy your premise that creator is the deistic. And let me ask just a, well, how would we adjudicate that? I mean, that's a hard debate to adjudicate. I'd say, well, look at the text of the Declaration of Independence. They appeal to divine providence at the end of the Declaration. Well, a deistic God is not a providential God, the supreme judge of the world. So
A designer God.
I know, but you don't appeal to a supreme judge. That implies a providential God. So I don't know that the presumption of your question is accurate, accurately describes them, right? That they only believed in a distant God. I mean, if you just read what George Washington says, he's appealing to providence all the time. Washington had two horses shot out from under him. I mean, that Washington survived the Revolutionary War. No, I mean, no wonder he believed in providence. And he believed in providence. But if you're constantly appealing to providence, that's evidence you don't believe in just a deistic God.
Okay, I want to get word in from a neo-Catholic.
I want to try and register my protest without stealing my own thunder from later this afternoon, so I don't want to say too much. I mean, I would just note, and then we can see later whether it's true, that I don't think your characterization of the neo-Catholic position, insofar as there is such a hypostasis, is adequate to that position. What I really want to say is that, you know, I think Bill is right. And what I'm always think is kind of funny about this is, on the one hand, everything seems, in other words, he's right in the very notion of God, providence, nature, what have you, is undergoing a radical transformation in the period that we're talking about. The meaning, the meanings lurking, the historical meanings behind these words is changing radically. And I'm always struck by the fact that people who make so much of, you know, the laws of nature and nature's God and the religious foundations of the Declaration seem to care very little about the content of that and the meaning of those terms. It's enough that they're there, but they're practically empty and formal. Surely, this kind of objection matters.
But they're not empty and formal, right? Not at all. That's what, I mean, you know, that was minutes, you know, 12 through 22 of my talk, trying to explain. They have real purchase, right, about the limits of government.
They have a content that's problematic. They have a content that reflects the changed understandings that Bill's talking about, I think.
Let me press back. What is it? Is it true? These are questions I posed to Patrick, and he never, so I'm not posing them to Michael. I always ask him, he never answers clearly. Do you not believe that all men are created equal? Because that is the fun. Do you not believe that? Do you believe some men are meant to govern others without their consent? Because if you
that's not the question.
That is the question.
No, that's not
and
the
if
question.
You if you do you believe that men do not have a right to religious freedom? Because everything I've said follows from those premises. So it's a yes or no question.
Michael's I think the claim that Bill and Michael are making is that do the founders provide us with adequate basis to sustain that conviction?
That depends on us, right? I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like, I have two little kids, right? You can raise your kids as well, but at the end of the day, they have to make their own choices, right? So a regime that aims at freedom, right, simply doesn't make its citizens good, right? So that's why there's this enormous effort of education, right? Right? Montesquieu says, those who are corrupt are rarely responsible. The first generation of a country that's corrupt is not at fault, it's the parents, right? Because if you have one or two generations of parents who teach their children poorly, the children stop knowing what's good and what's bad.
So you hold the
And
view,
so I would say, look.
You hold the view, though, that you hold the view that we ought not to have a polity that aims at more than freedom, but that's dangerous. We ought to have a culture that aims at virtue, but a polity that aims at freedom.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, that would have to be qualified, but in its essence, that's correct.
Okay,
thank you. My name's Greg Sinclair. I'm really grateful to be here, and thank you, Phil, for your great talk. I'm just adding a few points here, at least as I see it, which may or may not detract from what you suggested today. So if we look through history, I mean, a number of great leaders in the past have said evil prevails, because good men do nothing. So I see that as a pretty standard MO now, in, not just in the US, but across the planet now. The whole rush towards embracing liberalism is just not here, it's everywhere. You did raise a couple of good points in terms of, you know, these, you know, liberal ruling elites. As I see it, you know, one of the fundamental hypocrisies of the positions that they take, and you sort of touched on it a little bit today, that they keep touching on the laws of nature in terms of how they interpret it, meaning evolution, but then it's quite self-evident how nature conducts itself, and yet they disregard that and then accept completely abhorrent biblical standards for what marriage is, and they don't even see the hypocrisy. So I suggest to us as Catholics and Christians in this side of eternity, you know, that hypocrisy needs to be highlighted, quite frankly. That's my humble suggestion. And then you also suggested earlier, Philip, that that there's no right or wrong in the context of liberal views, but clearly that's not absolutely true. Because there is one wrong, and that's for those folks who stand for Christ. And you bet your bottom dollar, they'll be jumping all over you, that's wrong, but everything else is fine.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think modern liberalism, so I do, let me back up, I do the church state of thought of the founding. And if you, and so one of the biggest political debates of the founding is, you know, what do we do with the Church of England after the Revolution, right? So we had, Colonial Virginia established the Church of England, right? So very familiar with all these arguments for a religious establishment. And the same arguments for a religious establishment are being recycled in terms of in the modern university, you know, for safe spaces, for imposing, right, a certain orthodoxy. I mean, it's really what's going on is really an older politics of trying to reestablish a certain church. I mean, they don't call themselves a church. But I would say our neo-Catholic critics are trying to do the same thing. Everyone wants to establish their own orthodoxy and impose it on others. And what the political liberalism of the founding is trying to say, no, we need to have politics aim at freedom. That's a hard argument to make because, well, what happens if people abuse their freedom? And Madison's answer to that, well, what happens if people abuse their freedom, don't fulfill their religious obligations? And what Madison says, well, that's between them and God. And that a politics that tries to make people responsible for their religious obligations will end up being tyrannical. And that's true. There's tyranny on the right and tyranny on the left.
All right, we need to stay on schedule. We are going to have more opportunities after other speakers and then in our final session.
Please help us thank you again.